कुंज बिहारी जयो जयो यमुना तीरावन चारी जयो कुंज बिहारी जय राधा माधव जयो कुंज बिहारी जयो राधा माधव जयो कुंज बिहारी हरे कृष्णा कृष्ण कृष्ण हरे 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 राम हरे राम 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 हरे 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 कृष्णा कृष्णा कृष्ण हरे 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 राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे जय राधा माधव जय राधा माधव जय राधा माधव जय राधा माधव जय नवद्वीप धाम जय नवद्वीप धाम जय नवद्वीप धाम जय नवद्वीप धाम जय वृंदावन धाम जय वृंदावन धाम वृंदावन धाम जय वृंदावन धाम प्रभुपाद 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 जय प्रभुपाद विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राजकाचार्य स्तोत्र सत श्री श्रीमादेष्टमाइंद्रय अभय चरणारविंद भक्ति विरंत स्वामी श्रील प्रभुपाद की जय। इस्कॉन विभूति संस्थापक आचार्य श्रील प्रभुपाद की जय। इस्कॉन गुरुवृंद की जय। अनंत कोटि वैष्णव वृंद की जय। नामाचार्य श्रील हरिदास ठाकुर की जय। श्री रूप श्री सनातन भट्ट रघुनाथ योगपाल भट्टदास रघुनाथ सदगोस्वामी प्रभु की जय। प्रेम से कहो श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवास हरि श्री गौर भक्त वृंद की जय। श्री श्री राधा कृष्ण गोप गोपीनाथ श्याम कुंड राधा कुंड गिरि गोवर्धन की जय। वृंदावन धाम की जय। मथुरा धाम की जय। नवदीप मायापुर धाम की जय। जगन्नाथपुरी द्वारका धाम की जय। गंगा माए जीवन माए की जय। भक्ति रवि तुलसी महारानी की जय। हरिनाम संकीर्तन यज्ञ की जय। श्रील प्रभुपाद ट्रांसेंडेंटल बुक डिस्ट्रीब्यूशन की जय। समवेत भक्तवृंद की जय। जय नीता गौर प्रेमानंदे। ऑल ग्लोरीज टू द असेंबल डिवोटीज ऑल ग्लोरीज टू द असेंबल डिवोटीज ऑल ग्लोरीज टू द असेंबल डिवोटीज ऑल ग्लोरीज टू श्री गुरु श्री गौरांग ऑल ग्लोरीज श्रील प्रभुपाद। ओम ज्ञानातिमिरांधस्य ज्ञानंजनाशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्री गुरवे नमः। नमो विष्णु पदाय कृष्ण पृष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमद भक्ति चारु स्वामी नीति नामने स्निग्ध चेत सुप्राणेत वाग्मनम चरसाप्लुतम प्रभुपादगत प्राणम नौमि भक्ति चारु पदम नमो विष्णु पदाय कृष्ण पृष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी नीति नामने नमस्ते सरस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादि पश्चाति देश तारिणे मुखम करोति वाचालं पंगुम लंघायते गिरिम यत्कृपातमहं वंदे श्री गुरुं दिनतारिणम् ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयं मुदीरयेत् नष्टप्रायेषु अभद्रेषु नित्यं भगवत सेवया भगवती उत्तम श्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्ठिके Hare Krishna, thank you everyone for coming to this class. I beg for all your blessings that I might speak valuable words. And today we're reading from the 4th canto, chapter 6, entitled Brahma Satisfies Lord Shiva, text 5 till 7. I think 7 is on the board. So I'll read just 5, 6 and 7, and 7 we can chant together. Text 5, translation. You have excluded Lord Shiva from taking part in the sacrificial results, and therefore you are all offenders at his lotus feet. Still, if you go without mental reservations and surrender unto him and fall down at his lotus feet, he will be very pleased. Purport. Lord Shiva is also called Asutosh. Asu means very soon, and Tosha means to become satisfied. The demigods were advised to go to Lord Shiva and beg his pardon, and because he is very easily pleased, it was certain that their purpose would be served. Lord Brahma knew the mind of Lord Shiva very well, and he was confident that the demigods, who were offenders at his lotus feet, could mitigate their offenses by going to him and surrender without reservation. Text 6, which has no purport. Lord Brahma also advised them that Lord Shiva is so powerful that by his anger all the planets and their chief controllers can be destroyed immediately. Also, he said that Lord Shiva was especially sorry because he had recently lost his dear wife, and he was also very much afflicted by the unkind words of Daksha. Under the circumstances, Lord Brahma suggested it would behoove them to go at once and beg his pardon. Naham na yagyo na cha yoyamanye Naham na yagyo na cha yoyamanye Yadeha bhajo munayascha tattvam Yadeha bhajo munayascha tattvam Viduh pramanam bala virya yova Viduh pramanam bala virya yova Yasyatma tantrasya ka upayam vidhitset Yasyatma tantrasya ka upayam vidhitset Naham na yagyo na cha yoyamanye Ye deha bhajo munayascha tattvam Viduh pramanam bala virya yova Yasyatma tantrasya ka upayam vidhitset Please chant. others. Na, not. Aham, I. Na, nor. Yajnaha, Indra. Na, nor. Cha, and. Yuyam, all of you. Anye, others. Ye, who. Dehabhajaha, of those who bear material bodies. Munayaha, the sages. Cha, and. Tatvam, the truth. Viduhu, no. Pramanam, the extent. Balaviryayoho, of the strength and power. Va, or. Yasya, of Lord Shiva. Atmatantrasya, of Lord Shiva, who is self-dependent. Kaha, what? Upayam, means. Vidhitset, should wish to advise. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Lord Brahma said that no one, not even himself, Indra, all the members assembled in the sacrificial arena, or all the sages, could know how powerful Lord Shiva is. Under the circumstances, who would dare to commit an offense at his lotus feet? Purport. After Lord Brahma advised the demigods to go to Lord Shiva and beg his pardon, it was suggested how he should be satisfied and how the matter should be placed before him. Brahma also asserted that none of the conditioned souls, including himself and all the demigods, could know how to satisfy Lord Shiva. But he said, it is known that he is very easily satisfied. So let us try to satisfy him by falling at his lotus feet. Actually, the position of the subordinate is always to surrender to the Supreme. That is the instruction of the Bhagavad Gita. The Lord asks everyone to give up all kinds of concocted occupations and simply surrender unto him. That will protect the conditioned souls from all sinful reactions. Similarly, in this case, Brahma also suggested that they go and surrender unto the lotus feet of Lord Shiva, for since he is very kind and easily satisfied, this action would prove effective. So, about 2 weeks ago, I gave another class on the same section of chapters of the Bhagavatam. And devotees came to me after this class, and they very much appreciated the points I made in that class. And some of them indicated that they would like to hear some more elaboration on the things I said at that time. The class I gave then was on yajnas, and I described that Krishna, he gave the process of yajna for the conditioned souls to maintain themselves. It was basically on the main points I made, and I illustrated that how this culture of yajna was trying to become sabotaged by the Britishers, and then strip all India's wealth, make them poverty stricken, and then blame religion for that. So in essence, that was the point I made. So in this class, I'll try to elaborate on it. First I will just speak on the verse, and gradually I'll move towards that aspect. So in this way I hope to fulfill your desires, for those who requested me to do that. So, here the position of Lord Shiva comes into discussion. Lord Shiva, who is always auspicious, he's a very, very great, powerful personality. The Brahma Sangita, chapter 5, text number 10, he mentions that, that verse mentions that Mahavishnu, he resides within Lord Shiva in the form of the glands. And text 14, it says even that it is Lord Shiva who carries this Mahavishnu into the universe. In other words, Mahavishnu, or Garbhodaka Sai Vishnu more specifically, manifests out of Shiva. So that is his powerful position. Lord Shiva exists before all the devatas, all the demigods come into existence. At the time when Mahavishnu is impregnating the external energy via his reflection, Lord Shiva, at the time there are no devas, there are no conditioned devas. There are eternally liberated parshadas, but there are no devas. So one sense, Lord Shiva is the Aham Bija Pradapita, he's the father of all living entities, the seed-giving father. Then we have a deity not very far from here, Harihar. And Harihar shows that half of the position of Lord Shiva and Lord Vishnu means he has half his body is Lord Vishnu, half of his body is Lord Shiva. So it's very interesting to see that this similarity is there, because also the position of Siti is similar. Shiva has another form, Ardhana Arishva Shiva, in which half the body of Lord Shiva is Parvati or Sati and half his body is Shiva. So this half body thing is seen in Vishnu and Shiva. There are lingas in India like the, Lingaraj in Bhuvaneshwar. Also there they offer Bilva leaves and Tulsi leaves to the lingam, because it's understood that Shiva and Vishnu reside in that. So what is this mystery? The mystery is that the original form of Lord Shiva is Advaita Acharya. He is one person, but he's two also. Advaita, not two. So this Mahavishnu and Shiva in one. Shiva has a form of Sadashiva, in which he can take up a four-armed Narayan form. So this is the position of Lord Shiva. And then Sati is described as half of his body. Now, if you are half of the body of somebody, that means you are also half of the emotions or half of the heart of that person. Prabhupada mentions that the word Ardhangini, similar to Ardhana Ayurishchavar, which means half of one's body, refers to the wife. Like Lord Narayan is carrying Lakshmi on his wife and always keeps him in a loving, protective embrace, the wife should also be kept in a protective embrace by the husband. Just like one protects a money box, like that, you see. So the wife should be kept like that. So another point Prabhupada makes there is that Radha and Krishna are actually one, and they become eternally separated in order to perform pastimes. Here you see the same principle, that Sati is actually Shiva's, the half of Shiva's heart. That was the position of Sati. And she was so chaste to her husband that she was willing to give up her life for the sake of protecting her husband. She was not willing to hear any insults of her husband. So therefore, she became the symbol of Sati. Whenever chastity is mentioned, Sati comes first. And the rite of Sati, also named after her, in which a chaste housewife burns herself in the fire of separation, and literally in the fire pyre, is also coming from Sati. And only women who have the caliber of chastity of Sati can perform such rites. Therefore, Shiva became very much pained, and not even pained, he became completely mad and started dancing with that half-burned body. And with his aggressive tandav nritya, the world would be devastated. So the devas, they went and excited Lord Vishnu to do something. And Lord Vishnu, he used his Sudarshan Chakra to cut all these different parts of Shiva, Sati's body, which fell in different places in India, and became Shakti Peeths, places where Shakti is worshipped, Durga. So, these are some of the glories of Lord Shiva. But the main point here Lord Brahma is mentioning is surrender. He points out that Shiva is very pained and is also very much afflicted by the insulting words of Daksha. But if you simply go and touch his lotus feet, He's very easily pleased. I promise you that. I have confidence in that. So all the devas, see here another point is that if one partakes or sits with a person who is offensive, one shares the offense. So in the Garuda Puran, there is a whole section of a whole list given by Lord Krishna to Garuda speaking, how karma is exchanged. One of the things is if you sit and take prasad with some or food with somebody, you share half the karma, like that. If you share a vehicle with a person, you share half the karma. It's very obvious. If there's an accident, you'll also suffer. You can say, no, I'm innocent, I'm not, you know, but you sat in the car, so you share 50% of the karma. If you speak to a person, you get 1/6 of his karma. If you teach, you get 1/6 of the karma of the students. If you're a king, you get 1/6 of the karma of all your citizens, like that. There's a whole list. For those who want to know, you can refer to the Garuda Puran. So the devatas therefore were offensive. They were afraid to speak up against Daksha. So they, maunam samatir lakshanam. The Dharma Shastra speak that if you remain silent when an offense is made, means you're agreeing with that. So, Lord Brahma is making here the point of surrender. So now let's see what surrender actually is. In the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, and who's Patanjali? For your information, Patanjali is an incarnation of Lord Ananta Sesh. And he is the writer of the Yoga Sutras and many other books. But I'm going to refer to Patanjali's Yoga Sutras in order to clarify what is actually surrender. Yoga is a process. It's different from religion. Religion is a matter of faith. But yoga is given as a process. And anybody can take it up without even having to change his religion. Because the process of yoga is meant to come to your swarup, to realize your spiritual form. And right in the first chapter of this Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, he mentions yoga chitta vritti nirodha, which means yoga means to be able to control the vrittis of the mind, mind control. For what purpose? So that tada drishtaha swarupe avasthanam, so that the soul, the seer, will be able to see its spiritual form. He's right here in the first chapter of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. He mentions the essence of yoga is to obtain your spiritual form. Of course, there are many unauthorized commentaries of trying to merge with the Absolute. But that's not the purpose of Ananta Sesh, who is himself Ramanujacharya, came to defeat the Mayavadis. See? But the Mayavadis claimed Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. What does Krishna say? He says in the Gita, Jitatma prasantasya paramatma samahitaha siddhoshna sukhadukheshu tathamana pamanayo. Those who can reach, control the mind, they have reached the Super Soul. And they become oblivious to happiness and distress, heat and cold, fame and infamy. So by mind control, the Super Soul is reached. That's the purpose of yoga. Now, of course, you know Patanjali, he offers the method of Ashtanga Yoga, breathing, asanas, concentration. But in that first chapter, if you're interested, you can go to and read that. He mentions that if you can simply fully surrender, he mentions Ishvara Paridhana, which means full self-surrender to Ishvara, the Supreme Person of Godhead, then you have reached or can easily attain the goal of yoga. So there you go. That actually the highest form of yoga is to completely self-surrender, which is mentioned by Patanjali himself. Then he defines also what is Kaivalya, which is quoted by Prabhupada. Kaivalya, or liberation according to Patanjali, is Kaivalyam Sarupena Pratishtha Vachiti Shaktiriti. Kaivalya means that one becomes situated in one's spiritual form. Or Chiti Shaktiri means transcendental pleasure potency. So, then if that is like that, that means that surrender is yoga. Surrender is the process of yoga, and yoga is the process of surrender. So now, if one wants to understand surrender, one should be able to analyze that in the matters of yoga. So now Bhaktivinoda Thakur has given a definition of surrender. Mentions, Anukulyasya sankalpa pratikulyasya varjanam rakshishyatiti vishwaso goptritve varanam tatha atmanikshepa karpaniye shadvidha sharanagati. There are six limbs of surrender, and the first two ones are Anukulyasya sankalpa pratikulyasya varjanam, accepting things which are favorable for devotional service and rejecting things which are unfavorable for devotional service. See? So here we find the regulation of yama and niyama, asana and pranayama. One learns that overeating is not favorable for devotional service, so one does not overeat. things which are favorable, one accepts. So this is the anga of yama and niyama of yoga. And here also, in a matter of surrender, it's a matter of tapasya. One does not like to give up strawberry ice cream or chocolate ice cream. But one has to give up because it's not part of the yama niyama process, or anukulyasya and pratikulyasya, like that. So here one finds tapasya. Tapasya is an anga of surrender, which will purify you of your bad karmic reactions. Then rakshishatiti vishvaso goptritve varanam tatha. Having full faith that Krishna will always protect one, and accepting Lord Krishna as the only Lord and maintainer, like that. So here we find another limb of yoga, which is of pratyahara and dharana. Pratyahara means one does not take shelter in the sense objects. One retrieves the senses inward. One does not take shelter in the sense objects that they will gratify me. One does not take shelter in one's land, possessions, money, nationalism, family, all these things. These are all pratyahara, and mentioned in the process of surrender as rakshishatiti vishvaso. Then it indicates goptritve varanam tatha, taking Lord Krishna as the only maintainer and having full faith that he will protect. Of course, one's protection will be questioned, it will be tested when a difficult situation arises. Then the last ones, atmanikshepa karpaniye. Atmanikshepa means full surrender of the soul, and karpaniya means with full humility. So here, one can only fully surrender one's soul in a sense that one surrenders the mind and desire. Soul means there's desires and thoughts, like that. So if one surrenders that to the Supreme Lord, then that is called dhyan. The gopis, they mentioned in their gopi gita, na khalu gopika nandano bhavan akhila dehi naam antaratma drik. They mention, O Krishna, we know, so in their mood of separation and crying, they are meditating here. They are doing the topmost link of yoga by saying, Nakhalu gopika nandano bhavan. You are not actually the son of a gopika, Yashodamai, but you are actually the super soul, akhila dehi naam antaratma drik, and the witness of all our activities. So it is an indication that also the gopis know about this process of self-surrender. So this is then their meditation and humility, asking Lord Krishna to appear. So in this way, one can understand that yoga is surrender. Surrender is yoga. So referring to that aspect which I mentioned as Gurukul in my last lecture, yoga was also a very much practiced process for Gurukulis. Pranayam, asanas are very favorable for devotional service because then one learns how to sit properly. For all aspects of yoga, even bhakti yoga, you have to have a healthy body, healthy mind, and be able to breathe properly. Otherwise, how will you perform your devotional service? So in that sense, Ashtanga yoga is helpful here. We also find Prabhupada criticizing that the idea that not simply by pressing the nose one can become God. So that's obviously there. One can never become God. But by practicing yoga of surrender, also Patanjali agrees with that, one can develop these godly qualities. So therefore, yoga is another aspect essential for Gurukul training. And it, now we also understand how it purifies the mind and one's past karmic reactions. So this verse also mentions that surrender will protect one from one's past karmic reactions. So now, long time ago, I gave a class in which I tried to mention how actually the flow of karma works in connection with bhakti. So try to mention, it was not very clear at the time. But if one takes up bhakti, one finds that the karmic pattern which one obtains at one's birth, or the astrological pattern, does not change. Devotees also go to astrologers because, and when they go to astrologer, they don't take the time of their initiation as their time of their birth chart. They take the time of their birth as their birth chart. and all the obstacles which are mentioned in their birth chart or the karmic flow set by that pattern of the chart does not change. One has to accept that. It's a visible fact. So now, if that is there, one has to understand that even after initiation, after taking up the bhakti process, one's destiny is not changing. And what is destiny? Destiny is a situation one faces. Therefore also devotees can see, can also find through an astrologer, at this period I will be tested. At this period I will be tested. In that period I will be tested in several different ways. You might be praying to Lord Krishna, Govinda Prana Marore. Oh Govinda, you are my life and soul. And Krishna will say, okay, I'm your life and soul. Okay, I have here some karmic tests. I saw. Before you became a devotee, you were a devotee of Durga. Now you're my devotee, I will take those karmic tests and I'll test you. So, you know, we go to an astrology, we'll say within 2 years, Krishna will send a beautiful, beautiful Maya Devi. And then Krishna will say, okay, let's see if I'm your life and soul. Or maybe she's your life and soul now. So, one finds that the karmic pattern is not changing. Therefore, one cannot say that Krishna has interfered with that flow of karma. Simultaneously, as I mentioned then also, Krishna mentions also, Ye yatham mam prabhadyanste tam sathaiva bhajamyam. As one surrenders unto me, I reward him accordingly. So does that mean that Krishna is completely neutral and he does not reciprocate one's prayers? Well, in that lecture I mentioned many examples how Krishna reciprocated prayers and even protected devotees from karmic reactions. But it wasn't clear somehow or other. So, he responds to your prayers, but you have to pray. You have to do that step of surrender. Otherwise, if you think I will simply sit down and smoke marijuana and tell Krishna, you fight the battle of Kurukshetra, like Prabhupada says, it won't happen. You have to practice the six angas of surrender. Anukulyasya sankalpa prati. Then Krishna will reciprocate accordingly. He might increase or reduce your karmic reactions. Increase? Yes, also increase. See, I have some knowledge of palmistry. The left hand in male people represents the birth chart for the total karmic reactions of past life. The right one represents the reciprocative karmic reactions of your actions since time of birth. And unfortunately in my life, I'm seeing that this hand, my right hand, is worse than my left hand. So, I went to one of my devotee friends, who was an astrologer, I said, how is this possible? Krishna is supposed to reduce karma. Which he's giving more obstacles. He said, because he wants to purify you, accelerate your purification. See? So that's how Krishna also reacts, interacts. See? And yes, he sometimes reduces karma, manipulates karma. And in a matter of fact, in the case of a pure devotee, who are at the end of their karmic results, yesham tu antagatam papam jananam punya karmanam te dvandam moho nirmukta bhajante mam dritavrata. If he is really at the end of his karmic reactions, he is above duality of happiness and distress, good and bad, then he has actually transcended his birth chart pattern of karmic results. Right? I went to one devotee astrologer was mentioning that there's one devotee in Mayapur here, specifically mentioned his chart, and he said that he's supposed to have some very bad results at this age, this day and age, but nothing of these bad results came to this person. So that indicates that this person has transcended its karmic results. So, the point here is that if you are a devotee and you're developing good qualities, those good qualities should be cultivated to a certain extent that you can actually transcend your karmic reactions. That means devotee. The situations will come to you as they are described in the chart. But how you react upon that situation, that is your individual choice. You can become happy, you can become with distress, you can be upset with Krishna. Therefore, my main target in that lecture also was that therefore if an avalanche happens and you're in the mountains and your child gets crushed by the avalanche or a big boulder rolls from the mountain and your child becomes chutney and he was a chanting devotee, then don't blame Krishna for it. Now you understand how karma works in connection with bhakti. Unless you have transcended your karmic results, they will come upon you. Till then, keep on practicing. And don't blame Krishna. Oh, my child died. He was a devotee. Why are you so cruel? I cannot pray to you anymore. See, this is one of the big reasons devotees leave the movement. See, especially mothers have a lot of difficulty with this, because the child is the part of their body, like she was part of body Sati. So it's very difficult to give up emotional harm like that. It's very difficult because the child is part of your body, and this child is a part of your pride, part of your identity. And now Krishna takes that away. So like that. So therefore it should not become, if you properly understand how bhakti and karma interact with each other, it should not be a reason to leave devotional service, which is what happens, unfortunately. So now, one can easily conclude from this that surrender and yoga and sanatana dharma are the same thing. If Krishna mentions, sarva dharman parityajamamikam sharanam raja, sharanam, surrender is sanatana dharma, therefore yoga is sanatana dharma. Another great, very great benefit of practicing yoga is the purification of the subtle body. Prabhupada many times mentions that one has to purify the subtle senses. What are these subtle senses? Also that I mentioned long time ago in my classes, these are the chakras. What are chakras? As soon as Prabhupada refers to pranas, many times he does, one has to understand pranas, they flow in one's subtle body. The subtle body also have, like the gross body, veins. But these veins are not blood veins, they are veins of pranic flow. There where these veins cross each other, I think minimal 21 times, there a chakra manifests, which looks like a trumpet. It's an organ, a subtle organ, which has to be purified. These organs are the charging potency for your gross organs to function. There's something wrong with the chakra, and it's connected to the liver. Your liver will be malfunctioning, like that. So, why am I saying this? Because it's natural. Many, many people, pranic healers, scientists, are busy nowadays with this chakric science. So why should we remain behind, thinking something for somebody else? We also, as bhakti yogis, are purifying our subtle senses, the chakras. So, there's one devotee, when I was living on a youth forum, he came to me and he mentioned that he is a pranic healer. At that time I wasn't acquainted with this terminology at all. I wasn't looking for these kind of things, of yoga, you know, pranayama and things like that. I was just a regular ISKCON devotee, you know, condemning anything which is not mentioned by Prabhupada clearly, as I misunderstood it. But he mentioned that, no, pranas are mentioned by Prabhupada. The process of Ashtanga Yoga is mentioned by Prabhupada. There what he criticizes only that aspect of becoming one with God. One cannot become one with God by pressing the nose. But Ashtanga Yoga is a very helpful process for concentration, for increasing the quality of your chanting. So he mentioned that being a master in pranic healing, he had some Indian students. So what he did, he let them practice for some time and then purify their subtle senses. As a matter of fact, those who are very much attached to a high position, also in ISKCON, they will not rise beyond the belly chakra, the Manipurak chakra. In order to experience bhavas, one has to open or purify all the chakras, because bhavas are emotions on the transcendental, Shuddha Sattva, Vasudeva platform. So in order to obtain the experience of bhava, one has to come to that stage. This is the scientific explanation of Bhakti Yoga, very scientific. Now in order to see divine realms, because we're going to enter now, tomorrow you'll hear, a description of Kailash. Now if you go to the Himalayas, you find a mountain, snowy mountain, and that they call it Kailash. But the Kailash described here is completely different. So why is it different? So now, often I found devotees not being able to answer this question. And then therefore, they have to surrender to the offensive statements that your scriptures are all fairy tales and simply concoctions and bedtime stories. But it is not like that. If one understands the science of chakras, one purifies the Agya chakra, it becomes open. One can see the Kailash mountain as it is. See, this devotee was mentioning that he let his students chant the Shiva mantra for many days, Om Namah Shivaya. And he saw that some of his students were advanced enough. And then he said, now you meditate on Kailash and tell me what you see. So they went in a meditation, all these pranic healing and these chakra yoga students. And they described all the same description of Kailash, which exactly was identical to what the Bhagavatam says. See? So this, essentially for Gurukul education, increases and solidifies the faith of the Vedic students in the scriptures. When the sages speak, Rishi means seer. What does he see? He doesn't see only the butt of a woman like the the British educationers, the professors, you know, Rishi sees the subtle realms, the transcendental realms, by practicing this, whatever, yogic process. Therefore, yoga is universal. When I was in Holland, there was an article. In Holland, we have this thing called teletext, which is like news, but on television. It's not the same as newspapers. It's very summarized news. So there was an article that the Muslim leaders and the Pope were warning their followers not to practice yoga, otherwise it might influence their faith. See, because so many people are practicing yoga nowadays that they become worried about it. Because yoga is universal for everyone. It's not a point of faith. It's a process. See, and therefore you find Sanatana Dharma is a scientific process. So this is one aspect which was practiced in the past in Gurukul education. See? Then also, I mentioned in the other class the process of yoga. And one devotee came to me asking, but if you perform yoga, you'll get a very little bit. Because his experience was when he chanted and asked something from Krishna, Krishna gave a very little bit. And he wanted to know what was the cause for that. So one of the causes is obvious. You have to have the qualification also, otherwise Krishna won't give you the fruit. Prabhupada mentioned that. If you become qualified, Krishna can give you the world. But if you're not qualified, then even with your chanting, you won't get. So now I would like to illustrate something, and gradually I'll go more into more and more illustration examples, what Krishna can give. But first I'd like to mention Krishna's opinion on this yajna and dana. This is chapter 18, text number 5 of the Gita. Acts of sacrifice, charity, and penance are not to be given up. They must be performed. Indeed, sacrifice, charity, and penance purify even the great souls. See? Here, sacrifice, charity, and penance. These are the three cruxes of Gurukul education. In yajna, cow protection is essential. For the brahmanas, they depend on ghee, panchagavya for their yajnas. It's obvious. The kshatriyas, their essential duty is to lay down their lives on the battlefield in protecting cows and brahmanas. This is mentioned in the Markandeya Puran. In the Markandeya Puran, we have a queen called Mandalasa who blesses her son Alarka, may you lay your life on a battlefield in protecting cows and brahmanas. How does a kshatriya see cows? Cows are representatives of the 33 crores of devatas. So protecting cows, one protects the devas. Simultaneously, you have drank her breast's milk. Therefore, as a faithful son, you must protect your mother. This is the nobility one finds in kshatriyas. And by protecting brahmanas, one protects dharma. Now for a vaishya, what is the connection between cow protection and the wealth of a vaishya? For this, one first obvious thing is dairy farming. Another thing is that when I was talking to Bhakti Raghu Swami's disciples, they were mentioning to me that there are Vedic scriptures which describe agriculture. There's one written by, I think, Parashara and one by Kashyapa. And they deal with Krishi Shastra, the science of agriculture. And they mention a mixture of panchagavya, cow dung and ghee and milk, as a fertilizer for the soil. So they said, one of their students did that. And guess what? They had experimented on a banana tree. The leaves of the banana tree were 10 times the normal size. 10 times the normal size were the leaves of a banana tree. Here is the connection between cow protection and harvest on the field. And what is the Western way? To throw so much fertilizer, you know, potassium, call it potassium chloride or stuff like that, that your soil becomes exhausted and won't be able to produce anymore. This is the Vedic system. Cow, what is the power of cow protection? You know, if you protect the cows, you utilize their panchagavya for fertilizing the soil, then just one cabbage is enough to feed the entire Brahmachari ashram. Right? 10 times the size of a cabbage. Right? Can have every day, we can have paneer sabji with cabbage. Like that. So, of course, one is very much ignorant about this point, but I have a lot of faith in Bhakti Raghu Swami's projects, and I'm very happy that he's able, and he has successes in this. For a Shudra, his yajna would be And for a Vaishya, his yagya is to protect cows and his and agriculture. For a Shudra is to assist the upper three classes. In this way, yagya is meant for everyone and cow protection. Now, another very essential aspect in brahmacharya training, also in a gurukul, is to beg. Bhavati bhiksham dehi. Bhiksham dehi bhavati. Dehi bhiksham bhavati. This is our three versions of the same mantra, meant for brahmana, kshatriyas, and vaishyas. Why is begging so important? The other day, when I gave that class, one Mataji came to me saying about her, the way she's training in the Gurukul, and one point came to discussion. There was one boy, ex-Gurukuli, was complaining that he never had motherly affection and never learned how to deal with women, and he was blaming the Gurukul for that, because brahmacharya should not associate with women. It's true. But if you go begging, then there is the proper reciprocation between a brahmachari and a housewife. Say, bhavati bhiksham dehi, then she will give you the grains. It says, why does the cooking of a housewife taste so much better than the cooking of a man? It's because in the cooking of a housewife, the affection of her family resides. See, you get that. When I was in Vrindavan, one devotee living a long time in Vrindavan was mentioning to me, when I was mentioning his point of begging, he said that, yes, you know one Babaji, and he used to go around, he goes around begging from the Brajavasi Matajis. And he is just like a child in their hands. And they're so affectionate to him that, as a matter of fact, he is living his life as a beggar simply on the solidified affection of Brajagopis. Because the roti he gets is purely their affection. You see? This is the aspect of begging of a brahmachari. Begging is not simply meant to fill the belly, because in a gurukul, one had kitchens. The gurukulis and the brahmanas were also being supported by the kshatriyas in the gurukul education, and there was a kitchen in the gurukul. So why would they go out begging? For this, for learning how to interact with the external world, for seeing how the flying sotas are flying in the grihasthashram, where husband and wife are fighting, and also to get the affection of a mother from a housewife, like that. So this is very essential, this begging aspect. When I spoke to the Gurukuls of Bhaktivedanta Purnaswami, they were saying that we don't go begging, because we think we don't get anything if we go begging in the Grihastha department. So that is their feeling. They feel we won't get anything from them. So maybe you can inspire them that, okay, not maybe all at once, but maybe two or three in a week can come and beg. And you can give them your own nicely cooked rotis, so that these poor brahmacharis will learn how to respect the mother, interact with motherly affection, which is very much part of the Gurukul education. On top of that, Krishna mentions piety should not be given up. See, there's equally a win-win situation. He comes begging, a nicely situated brahmachari, and you give a donation. So you get return. How much? Krishna knows how much he will give you in return. So in this way, there's an interaction of learning and piety from both sides. It was also a very essential aspect of begging, that in this way the Gurukulis get the affection they need so much. So now, I give in that class a quote of Macaulay. Would you like to hear this again, this quote of Macaulay? I will read it again, and then I'll try to illustrate now what the British were up to, how they destroyed this Vedic system of education. I'll read again. I've traveled across the length and breadth of India, and I've not seen one person who's a beggar, who's a thief. Such wealth I've seen in this country, such high moral values, people of such caliber, that I think, that I do not think we would ever conquer this country unless we break the very backbone of this nation, which is a spiritual culture and heritage. And therefore I propose that we replace our old ancient education system, our culture, for if the Indians think that all that is foreign and English is good and greater than their own, they will lose their self-esteem, their native culture, and they will become what we want them, a truly dominated nation. This is an address to the British Parliament, dated 2nd of February, 1835. So, I just repeated this so that you will not forget what the plan was of India, what Prabhupada gave us. So now I would like to illustrate, because they would have wanted to hear some more examples of what I was speaking the other time. So Macaulay speaks here, he says that, I haven't seen a person who's a beggar or who's a thief. So interestingly enough, the Mughals, who were in charge of India at that time, they also wrote some things about India. here's some example. This is from the very difficult to pronounce title of a book. Taziyatu al-Amsar is a book by the Mughals. They say, India is the most agreeable abode on earth and the most pleasant quarter of the world. Its dust is purer than air, and its air is purer than purity itself. Its delightful plains resemble the garden of paradise, and the particles of its earth are like rubies and gems. Another Mughal he mentions, if it is asserted that paradise is in India, be not surprised, because paradise itself is not comparable to it, to India. This is what they said about India, and that is what Macaulay said about India, about the nobility of the Indians. Sorry? This is 1735, around that time. This is 1635, 1735. This is around when the British were already in India. Around 1800 they gained control of India. Before that they were coming and, trading, so to say, but they were actually looting India. So then he mentions, of course there are many more quotes, but because I have very little time, sorry, the time, I have to just select those ones. Such wealth I have seen in this country. Now listen to this one, an example of wealth of India. The Kohinoor diamond from the gold mines of Golconda. Kohinoor is the biggest diamond ever in history, which was India's possession. And this is from a book named The Dance of the Peacock. It's quoting the Kohinoor. 787 carats now cut and placed on the Queen, on Queen Victoria's crown. It says, if a strong man should take 5 stone and should cast them one east, one west, one north, and one to the south, and the last one up in the air. Okay, a strong man has to cast 5 stones. If you stand in front of the temple and you cast a stone towards the main gate, that's about, I think, strength of a strong man, right? Is it possible to cast a stone towards the main gate and hit the main gate? I think it's possible. I had a school friend who was very able to throw a stone like. And if one stays in front of the temple, one has to throw a stone and it will hit the main gate. Then the same distance one has to throw a stone towards the Gurukul. Then one in the east and the west, and one in the air. Then it says, and if all the space between these points were filled with golden gems, that would not equal the value of the Kohinoor. It would not equal the value of the Kohinoor. This was India's gem, which was cut to small, reduced to small size, and is now on the crown of Queen Victoria. See? Another example here. This is from Nadir Shah. The greatest plunder in history in 1739 by Nadir Shah, valuables, British sterling pounds. Listen to this. 7,339,000,000 British sterling pounds. Equal value of gold, ruby, silver. The greatest plunder ever. In euros, it would be 9,855,000,000 euros. Million euros. India's wealth. And this was only one plunder of Nadir Shah. Then there is also a description of a globe around 45 centimeters diameter, solid gold, which is inlaid with 51,000 gems. This is also the loot of the first raid of Nadir Shah in India. So it's not surprising that he says, such wealth I've seen in this country, and such high moral values. Now, moral values, the chastity of the Indian women was really like a legend, legendary. In the Mughal period, in Chittor, the Sultan of Sarangapur came disguised to visit Chittor. Chittor, at that time, was the main seat of the Rajputs, of the Suryavanshi Rajputs. He came disguised as a Mughal, disguised as a Hindu, and he found out, and when he returned, the secrets he wanted, when he returned, he mentioned to his minister, the reason why these Rajputs are so ferocious and strong, because their women are so chaste. There is the chastity of their women is the strength behind the force of a Rajput warrior. We don't have such women, right? Therefore, we have to depend on numbers of soldiers like that. Another example is that Karna he mentions in the Mahabharata to Krishna. When Krishna reveals to him, you are the eldest Pandava, he says that, my dear Lord Vasudev, I know that that army for whom Draupadi is praying for victory can never be defeated. Because Draupadi is a symbol of chastity. Another thing is that in the Ramayana one finds that when Lakshman was hurt by an arrow and was lying unconscious on the battlefield, the cultural understanding is that Mother Sita was praying with all her chastity for the recovery of Lakshman. Chastity has tremendous power, that even Lord Krishna will not do anything against it. It says that Gandhari cursed Krishna, Krishna's dynasty, that he would disappear by her chastity. Another thing he mentions is that people of such caliber, now I go to a scene here, if you have, there's a BBC documentary entitled Partition Day, the day India burned. You know, BBC is making some documentaries. Now, they mention a scene, a village scene in Punjab, 1947. The time when India was really in a lot of anxiety was there, whether my village would be part of Pakistan or part of India. So there was one Punjabi village. And in that village, they wanted to make sure that it would be part of Punjab. So the men who had learned, one man was there only, who knew how to fight and shoot with a gun. So he's training the other men, if something happens, I'll train you how to shoot. So the Muslims, they heard about this, and they outnumbered the Sikhs in this way, and they came to attack the village, to, you know, whatever they wanted to do. So all these Sikh men were in anxiety, because they were also protecting the local Muslims. So then the village head went to that crowd, and there was one Muslim, also part of that village, who told the Sikh leader, you see, if you give me one woman, one of your women, I'll promise you, I'll make the entire Muslim crowd return. See? So the man who's narrating, you can see that in the scene, he's now old and grey with a long beard. He said that he was a young boy at the time when that happened. So then his father, the village head, he called his daughter, Mannu Devi, Mannu, come down, Mannu Beti Aja. So this daughter, she sat down in front of the father, and he took out this kripan, the Sikh weapon, and he hit her on the head, but nothing happened. Actually, the man says that only God knows what happened. Then he took the hair, you know, he threw the hair ahead, and he hit her again with the kripan, and her head rolled on the ground like that. So when he said that, he started crying, because this was his sister. So when the Sikh leader of this village initiated this, all over the village, you know, the sounds of heads rolling on the ground were heard. None of the women ever cried or, you know, screamed out. Only one thing was heard, he says, in the village, the name of God. I think the Sikh name is Vaheguru. They say Vaheguru, Vaheguru. So here is an example of the caliber of people the British saw. For those who have enjoyed fame, ill fame is worse than death. Not even, we'll kill our daughters, but not even one will be touched by the Muslims. See, this is another example of Sati. Sati has the same purpose. So if there is no time to build a fire, then this was being done. Also in Jaisalmer, the same thing happened. When there was no time to build a fire, the Rajput king personally went to his queens and chopped their heads. Like that. A whole river of blood streamed. The Mughals were surprised. This is the caliber of people of India. Like that. Then the last thing I should mention is that to break the very backbone. Already I mentioned last time how to break the backbone of the Indians. One main thing is that the conspiracy of the Britishers was to replace their teachers with British education. And they did that by blaspheming the Brahmanas, saying that they were all, you know, abuses of the caste system, and putting themselves on top and then suppressing the lowers. Prabhupada mentions, yeah, that also happened. And he specifically mentions Bengal. But then he also mentions that Bengali Brahmanas were polluted by tantric misdeeds. But Prabhupada himself was very much in favor of the South Indian Brahmanas. And also Max Muller and Wilson, they mentioned that, he says that, this is Wilson, quoted by Max Muller, the studies which engaged my leisure brought me into connection with men of learning. And in them I found the similar merits of industry, intelligence, cheerfulness, frankness with others particular to their avocation. A very common character of these men of the Hindus especially was simplicity, truly childish, and a total unacquaintance with the business and manners of life, of the Europeans of course. Where that feature was lost, it was chiefly by those who had been long familiar with Europeans. Among the Pandits and the learned Hindus, there prevailed great ignorance and dread of the European character. See, so the Muslim enslaved the bodies of the followers of Varnashram, but the British actually enslaved their minds. And Prabhupada says that, Apan dhan bilai de bhikkhamange porer kache, that the Indians went to beg in the West for materialistic education because their mind was enslaved. This is the first thing Prabhupada tried to destroy in his teaching. He tried to give the pride of Krishna consciousness. See, instead of enslaving the mind to the materialistic British education, other things they did is that they let this Max Müller, they polluted him first because he was very much in favor of the Vedic scriptures before that, but Macaulay polluted him. And then he claimed the Vedas and the Puranas were simply fairy tales and concocted and things like that. And then he illustrated, or they made the Hindu society to become synonymous to a backward, subcultured, superstitious people, who have a God for everything. And this is the reason why Hindus all over the world are actually ashamed of their culture. It's all manipulation of that British mentality. Another thing they did is the Aryan invasion theory. They claim that the Aryans came from outside. So the Indians who claim the land to be theirs as Aryans are completely mistaken because invaders have actually made their country. So it can lay no claim to their country. This is one of their theories. But of course it's all completely baloney because we find in the Bhagavatam that Satyavrata, he became the next Manu, but he was the king of Dravidadesh. So how do you reconcile that? And another thing is that in the Mahabharata one finds, what is his name? The father of Madri. Shalya. Shalya was the king of Madras and known as one of the most valorous warriors and very much respected. You see? That was the relationship between North and South Indians, but for the sake of bagging votes, the Indian politicians can do any damn nonsense, you see? So, this Macaulayism, one has to be very much aware, is still going on. The Asuric states of America, the United Asurdom, and the Asurian Union, or America, England and Europe, have extended now. They have now started to manipulate the world in the following way. See, in the time of the Britishers, they came to India, and they claim, and occupied the country. Now, what does America want to do, along with Europe and England, Asuric States of America, they claim to have now a globalism. Why are you so backward? Globalize, let's make one big globe, one nation in which they will be in charge. See, this is going on. Very, very clever. As a matter of fact, the Americans outwit the Britishers in their manipulation. See, they were the ones who broke down the Twin Towers. Again, I refer you to the BBC documentaries. they very much give clear evidence that it was Bush who blew up the Twin Towers. And for whatever reason. So therefore, one has to be very careful and try to follow Prabhupada's instructions very clearly and in order to regain that pride. So, one might question that, if the Kshatriyas were so noble and valorous, why did they lose all this? Why do the Indians lose all their property? Just like one can ask, how did ISKCON lose all this wealth? The first generation of the Prabhupada, I'm from the Belgian Dutch Yatra, I heard at that time, I'm about to stop here, that in the time of Bhagwan, he used to eat from solid gold plates. He used to sleep on beds in his Yatra which were gold plated. That was ISKCON's wealth. How did ISKCON lose it? Same question arises. They lost it because of Vaishnava aparads. See? This is one of the reasons the Kshatriyas lost the battles. Mewar lost its battles to the Muslims because they were offending Mirabai. So anybody offends Mirabai, be very careful. Another reason the Kshatriyas lost the battles because they couldn't unite. Because Kshatriyas are sportsmen of warriors. It's like every year there are some kind of Olympic games or some kind of games are there. Games are simply competition. So Kshatriyas as a competition would fight each other. Gain or victory was not important. If you die on a battlefield, you go to your desired destination. So there was some reason to fight. And of course, political reasons, they couldn't unite. Another thing was that the Kshatriyas, the Kshatriyas who are still there, they follow the Kshatriya code that you cannot shoot on the back of an enemy. If he's fleeing, you must let him go. And Kshatriyas would lay down their lives for protecting cows. So one of the Mughal invaders, Muhammad Ghori, how he captured Chauhan, who defeated him 17 times. The 18th time, Ghori, he came with an army shielded by cattle, by cows. So the Rajputs had to lay down their weapons. And that's how he got defeated. Then when he captured him, then Chauhan said to Ghori, I let you go 17 times. Can't you let me go even one time? Then he said, the mistake you made 17 times, I'm not going to make one time. See, I cannot give up, you know, an Aryan lion, such a dangerous lion like you. So he blinded him and he brought him to Afghanistan. Yeah, another thing here, mentioning lions. It's a common understanding in India that if somebody is very powerful, you know, like a very powerful heroic warrior, they say, Lagta hai sherni ka doodh piya hai. It seems that he has drunk the milk of a lioness, isn't it? It's an Indian saying. Why do they say it like that? Because motherly affection in India is not only respected, it's worshipped. And if that mother turns to be a lioness, she will have sons like lions. See, we find this example with Kunti. When Krishna came as a peace envoy, then Kunti gave him, he asked Krishna to Kunti, do you have any message for your sons? He said, yes. Tell Yudhishthir that the day for which Kshatrani's bear children has come. See, the day why Kshatrani's give children has come. Tell that to Yudhishthir. See, you find here that a lioness gives birth to lions, warriors like that, who are very faithful in protecting the religious principles. Another very obvious reason why the Kshatriyas lost the battles, because the Britishers had superior weapons. There's an article in the Mahabharata by Ganguly. He quotes the Gazette, a magazine at the time of 1800 when he was translating this Mahabharata, in which there was an article that in the court, in the Mahabharata court, one person came with an iron stick which was spitting out bullets, in other words, a musket, a gun. But the Brahmanas didn't allow the king to use that because he said this is meant for the Kali Yuga kings, not for Dwapara Yuga kings. There is no heroism in using this weapon. You must use your sword. See? And when the Britishers attacked China, the Chinese had a closed gate policy and they wanted to have an open gate policy. Then the Chinese emperor, he sent his warriors. See, the culture of the Chinese and Indians are more or less the same. He sent his warriors to attack, defend their empire. And the Britishers were simply lying down. And the army, the general gave the order, shoot as many as you can. So as the Chinese warriors ran with their weapons, swords and their spears, they were being shot to death without being able to show any heroism or any skill of warfare which they had. So then what happened, and it's very peculiar, the army general describes, he says that so many of them were killed and so many injured lying on the ground. The remaining warriors, instead of fighting us, they threw down their weapons and they, in disgust disappointed, they were walking back on the battlefield. They're not fleeing, they were walking back. See, the heroism was they would never flee from the battlefield like a Kshatriya warrior. But here they had an enemy which was hunting upon them like a low-class hunter which is outside Varnashram. So they were not equal a battle, see, with the Britishers. So then this army general commanded, stop shooting them. And whatever warriors remained alive, they patched them and brought them back to the emperor in order to have some good connections. This is an example how the Kshatriyas were unfamiliar with the low-class fighting spirit of called Malacha warfare. So just like the Brahmanas were unfamiliar with the wickedness of the Britishers. Like that. That's one other reason they lost battles. And the main reason which is mentioned in the Bhagavatam in the Hiranyama class is that in the 11th canto, quoting from the purpose of the Acharyas, it's described that all the sins performed in Satya, Treta and Dwapar Yuga, the reactions were not faced in those yugas. All the reactions are accumulated and faced in Kali Yuga. So Kali Yuga is the drain of the three other yugas in which all these things are happening. Devatas are being blasphemed in a country where they worship devas. See, Mother Sita is being, you know, ill-famedly blasphemed by Muslims in many, many ways. And they had the South Indian politician who was, you know, garlanding a Ram deity with shoes and things like that. These are all reactions and the sewage of the other yugas in which the sewage inhabitants become very powerful, like that. So at my class here, I'm completely over time. I beg your forgiveness if there's any question or comments. You can get the mic.
Hare Krishna. Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. India is it has a glorious past, but it seems to me that there are cycles of ups and downs. Like the bad things you see in India, as you've mentioned, are because of foreign influences. So like the bad things we see now are because of or the mindset of Indians are because of the British. And there are other batches also, like the batches, let's say like during Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's time, you probably would see bad elements because of the influence of Muslims. Yeah, according to your lecture, according to how you're speaking, there's like Jagai Madai, for example. And so let's say Jagai Madai and this medieval time, during Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's time, that would be because of the Muslims, right? Yeah? And let's say during Buddhism, Lord Buddha, during that time, when...
So during what? Sorry?
During Lord Buddha's time, 2000 years ago.
Buddhist time?
Yeah, Buddhist
time. Okay, that means Chanakya, okay.
Yeah, then you'd have people that were killing in the name of religion. And so what influence was that because of?
So your question is... Okay, I illustrated the Britishers, the Muslims. The reason
there are different batches. There are batches like now, there are batches during medieval times, during Buddha's time. Throughout history, we find that there are bad elements. And so according to your lecture, these bad elements could only be because of foreign influence.
Not only. I'll clarify that. Why I mentioned the recent history is because the old history is very difficult for devotees to understand. Recent history gives you a clear understanding what the present situation is from very recent. But I could give the same lecture on Chanakya's time, time of Mahabharata. Chanakya himself says, Vishwasa naiva kartavyam strishu rajakuleshuva. When he says a rajakulesha, a politician, he doesn't mean a Muslim politician or a British politician. He means a Hindu politician. Politicians are like that. So this is one thing. So your question is that there were ups and downs. Now your question is, what was the cause of down? Of down period during the time of Chanakya, right? Okay, so that's your question. The down period at the time of Chanakya was the invasion of Alexander. Now Alexander, though he was a Mlechha warrior, he was much more noble than any of the Mughals or any of the Britishers. And therefore, he's known to be Alexander the Great. He was very fond of renunciates and rishis, he used to go to the forests and learn from them, like that. So the reason why they were declining at the time is that if you see the serial of Chanakya, I can't say much about Chanakya because I haven't read it much, but I've seen the serial of Chanakya, which is documented serial, is that these Kshatriyas were again not united, see, because of sense gratification. And gradually in time, the deterioration comes. And in the time of Chanakya, when Alexander's army came in, then of course, one of the main reasons is that time goes through different modes. When a mode of goodness is prominent, devatas are victorious. When a mode of ignorance and passion is prominent, asuras and demons are prominent. So Kali Yuga is a time, and as an astrologer you know that Rahu and Ketu are very much prominent. And demonic influence are very prominent. So since the time of Chanakya, we find we find an initiation period of the Asuric influence is becoming very much prominent because the modes are favorable. See. Alexander the Great invaded India and he came up to Pataliputra, up to Patna. He invaded half of India. And therefore Chanakya, he found a non-caste conscious boy, Chandragupta, and made him the emperor. Because he was born in Pataliputra, modern day Patna. And then he trained him up to become the next empire. But he wanted to invade again India, Alexander. But because he ran out of money and supplies, his army declined to fight. And he was afraid because the Magadha Desh Empire, the empire of Bihar at the time, was known for its enormous amount of elephants. And they were afraid of the elephants. They returned. And when he returned, Alexander died in his empire somewhere in the Middle East and never came back. That's how it ended there. That's the thing with Chanakya and Alexander. Yeah. The decline of Mahaprabhu's time is, according to what I understood, is that as we have the cycles of the planets, and we have the cycles of the yugas also, within the Kali Yuga, you have Kali Satya, Kali Satya Dwapar, Kali Kali Kali. Mahaprabhu came in a period when Kali 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 was very prominent. And at that time, as you read in the Chaitanya Bhagavat, there was so much degradation in Navadvip here. They were marrying cats and dogs because they had so much wealth, they didn't know what to do with it. So they were offending. You offend the Veda mantras by doing such kind of things. Right? That happens if so much wealth comes in and you don't know how to properly deal with it. Right? Then these offenses come up. Offenses were the cause of the downfall at the time. Tantrism was there, pride of the Brahmanas, Vaishnava offense to the Vaishnavas. I mentioned Mevar. One devotee was offended and all Mevar had to taste defeat of the Mughals. Here, so many Vaishnavas were offended that they were even afraid of going outside. Now Mahaprabhu appeared. So that's one of the main reasons I can say about the decline periods. Also I mentioned ISKCON, offenses. What is all this wealth of which Bhagavan Das used to enjoy, where is all this wealth gone? Offenses. Okay? Other question? There's one question there. Doesn't work. It works now.
Hare Krishna. Hare Bo. Thank you for a very alive class and very inspiring. My first question is to do with the beginning of the Bhagavatam class, and you said that ultimately we have to have Krishna's protection, that's full surrender. So how do you know if you're going for Krishna's protection or you're expecting Krishna to serve you?
Okay, the question is, how do you know that you're depending on Krishna's protection or that you're demanding Krishna to protect you or you want to demand Krishna to serve you? I have a lot of difficulty with that myself. Therefore, the class I give that day, you can take it as a Siddhanti class or a class of reconciliation. Because the thing is, Krishna made a promise. On the strength of a promise, you can quote his promise. Kaunteya prati janihi name bhakta pranasyati. My devotees will never perish. So now when you're in difficulty, you're praying to Krishna and there's no help coming, how will you take that? Is Krishna not responding to you, or are you not a devotee in his eyes? Like that. See? So there's a major difficulty there. So if you take it philosophically, then one simply has to accept, okay, it's my karma. And how does it work? Therefore I illustrated that. How do you know it's you're asking Krishna to serve or you're asking protection? In my personal opinion, you might agree or disagree with that, jivas have the right to claim that protection once you become a devotee. Because Krishna promised that. And as a kshatriya, Krishna has the mood of a kshatriya makes a promise and he will fulfill it on the cost of his life, like that. So if that does not happen, then, like many Brajavasis say, maybe as a joke or whatever, but Krishna is a cheater. He makes many promises, but he does not fulfill them. So you can take it as rasa, but when such a thing happens that your child gets killed, then it's very difficult to see the rasa in that. Ultimately, it's all a test of your faith. So ultimately it's all a test. But it's very difficult at the time. I think that's all I can say maybe. But would you like to answer that question?
Okay, no? Thank you. And another question I have is to do with, you responded that it's not easy to to get the visions or that, but then you explained in the class that these students, they got this vision of Kailash. So now I'm
sort of... You want to know how they got it? How do they become so qualified? Okay.
Yeah.
One thing that is they have to have the pious credit. I mentioned these were all Indian students. So those who take a birth in Bharatvarsh have the Punya Karma, one thing, because Shiva is a very favorite of the Indians. One thing is that they have an affectionate relationship. Another thing is that the, missed the point. This one was about to mention that. I think Rishi was blocking me. Please, Om Namah Shivaya, let me answer the question I wanted to answer. Yes, yeah, I mentioned that it's very difficult to come to that stage, right? Why is it difficult also? Because all this impiety blocks your chakras. Impiety means you're very attached to the lower activities, the activity of the genitals. So these chakras become very big and they suck up all the energy of the upper chakras. It means to raise the upper chakras. So if you are pious, then even Hindus in India, they get Shiva's vision in a dream or things like that. So it needs piety, it needed a pure desire. And Shiva was very merciful to even the lowest fallen, like even the Bhutas and the Pretas. But then you still have to please Lord Shiva. Therefore this person was telling them, you chant Om Namah Shivaya so many times. And then you meditate and beg Lord Shiva to show you what Kailash really is. And they got the vision, like that. In my opinion, as far as I have any realization of Lord Shiva, he would allow his devotees to see Kailash with sincerity and pleasing him. Because his devotees have that piety. Prabhupada gave that piety. Prabhupada. They told the hippies, you don't have any pious credit. But they asked Prabhupada, we didn't have any pious credit. How can we chant Hare Krishna? I created your pious credit. I created your sukriti, he said, like that. I would say that his devotees, in my, that's what I would, for sure might be of another opinion, but I would say that ISKCON devotees have been practicing 10 or 15 years. They would have the credit to see Lord Shiva's Kailash Parvat if you would like to show them. Get the last one.
About this thing, about opening the chakras. I think in spiritual life, the chakras are being opened because by the mercy of Guru and by so many practices we have. Like when we chant the Maha Mantra, and you said this chakra is most important, no? If we chant without offense, we will see that the chakras are opening because they say also this is the chakra of communication, no? And it becomes purified by chanting mantras perfectly. So which mantra is more perfect and can be chanted more perfectly than the holy name? So when you chant the holy name perfectly in a personal way, without being indifferent towards the holy name, then automatically this chakra will open and all the other chakras follow.
Yes, I agree with that point. Let me mention that. The purpose I mentioned that is it will strengthen your faith in the scriptures. If by scientifically explaining the process of bhakti yoga, you can gain people's faith in it, it's that for that purpose. I didn't mention it that devotees should concentrate on opening their chakras. And if you mention that you can sense it, that means you can sense it. There are many devotees who don't sense anything, who are very insensitive about opening chakras. You sense it because probably you have some realization about that. But it is helpful in our preaching because there is a market for it. There's a market. There are books sold in big libraries or big shops who are dealing with these kind of things. So if it is our field, why do we not, you know, lead that field? That was my point. Then explain how through bhakti yoga chakras open. The people take up bhakti yoga and chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. That was my point.
And, do you know where, in which scripture, somewhere it mentioned Sanatana Goswami or Jiva Goswami, they mention that if you practice Krishna consciousness and you cannot concentrate, then you can use pranayama and hatha yoga as a support. Do you know where is that mentioned?
This is not so much mentioned by Jiva Goswami, Rupa Goswami, because they are bhakti acharyas. and they only deal with Bhakti Shastras.
I knew which scripture, but
you have
I
a quote?
Huh?
You have somewhere
I
a reference?
Which is there? That's why I'm asking you, maybe you know.
Yeah, I'm saying that. I haven't seen, but I can mention that.
It is somewhere.
I can mention Bhaktivinoda Thakur giving a reference. Another thing is that, very simply, for the sake of maintaining your health, these things are there. Instead, I'm more in favor of yogic exercises than playing football by the Gurukulis. Playing football, for the sake of improving your health, they do not. But you can also practice yoga for improving your health. So in favor of that, yogic exercises and pranayama are all coming from Patanjali, who's a bona fide yoga acharya. Prabhupada quotes him like that. And that way you can refer. Otherwise, you have to go through many Upanishads. There is a book called the 31 Minor Upanishads. And that book has been divided in three sections. And one section is called Yogic Upanishads, in which all these things are mentioned. How mantra chanting, how, you know, the chakras are opening and things like that. It's a mechanical way. But people, of course, are very much absorbed in mechanistic ways of understanding. This is a very good explanation if you can explain Bhakti Yoga like that. The point is to bring them to chanting Hare Krishna. So there you find, Upanishads you find. And Prabhupada somewhere mentions Adhik Sati when she leaves the body. Then Prabhupada mentions there. For the rest, Jiva Goswami, Rupa Goswami, I have no clear idea where they mention.
No, it is there, I'm sure about it, because okay. I used to know it in the past, but I have forgotten. In one, maybe Hari Bhakti Vilas or something. I don't know. Some of the writings, okay. It is mentioned like that. That if someone cannot concentrate the mind by chanting Hare Krishna, then he can practice Hatha Yoga and Pranayama as a support. But I have to find where
the support. The support is very simple. You learn how to sit for a long time, and you learn how to breathe properly.
Yeah.
So it's very favorable. What's the difficulty? Instead of playing football and doing gymnastics and things like that, why not take that process?
And another thing I want to ask you, you mentioned about the global invasion, no? This conspiracy from the Western, like American and so on. As you said, in the old times, when there was invasion, one would, according to their warrior capacity, they will, someone will have a victory, no? But in the modern times, as you said before, with the fire guns, and now they have even much heavier weapons.
I know, I'm aware of it.
Which are very subtle. And they are also particularly, it is not mentioned openly, but somehow these people are worshipping also very powerful demons. And they are supporting their whatever they are doing by having some... they get mercy from the very powerful people.
Yeah, well, I'm aware of the things you're saying about the UFOs and things like that about America, but unless I have documented evidence...
No, I didn't mention anything about UFOs.
Oh, okay. Anyway, somebody told me about the demons
coming. No, I said they are worshipping.
Worshipping demons. Yeah. It has to do with that aspect of cattle. And
from there they get intelligence and they develop very subtle weapons, which is very difficult to, like, subtle weapons of mind control and all these things. How we devotees, and these things come through also all these machinery, computers, cell phones, and all these things that are coming in our life, all those towers which transmit all those waves. And so the whole atmosphere is created where they can control through all this, no? So to fight the battle with them.
What is the new question?
The question is, as devotees, how can we protect ourselves from all this if we are using all those systems they have produced in our devotional service? Like my husband is all day translating in front of the computer, and he can feel that, oh, this thing produces such an energy whose mind...
So how you protect is, you know, by using your intelligence. If you see that there's so much beta radiation coming from your screen and you know, hypnotizes your husband, then take another screen, like that. I mean, I'm not a technician, but some things are very common. Some things are harmful. What is the need if I see sometimes devotees wearing sunglasses, sitting on a motorbike, just like a Western American, you know, trying to drive on, you know, racing on the Taranpur Road? Is that devotional service? No, these things don't happen. This is all influence I'm mentioning. It's coming in, infiltrating. But so we should protect it by being steady and sincere. You came to Krishna consciousness to obtain Krishna. That was your goal. So now Prabhupada gave a process. And anything else you adapt to it might be dangerous. I mentioned in the last lecture also mobile phones and you know, and the pen drives. There's a little last thing, and I just have to end completely, is that in the Cold World War, at a time when America and Russia had this Cold War, there was an example, I heard it from my school teacher, I was in school at the time, that Americans had sold telephones to Russia. So the company who made it, they were ordered by the government to first bring all these telephones to them, and then ship them to America. So later they discovered, I think the Russians discovered, why the Americans did that. They demanded the company to give them the telephones, so they would implant the chip in that. And by that chip, by remote control, America was able to just completely silence or, you know, lay lame the communication system in Russia, if they're in case of war. So you're using mobile phones and things like that, well, who knows what is in there? Who knows what is in there? And they're putting up many, many so-called weather satellites. Are you sure they are weather satellites? You know, satellites are putting up in space, the Americans, after so much study. So it's weather satellite. Are you sure they are weather satellites? Nobody can check that. No? So they can put up anything in there. But it's what you're mentioning, mind weapons and things like that. So we simply have to stick to what Prabhupada said, keep chanting Hare Krishna. We have to learn to control the mind. Otherwise, these weapons will influence us. Okay, we only have to end here. Granth Rajamit Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Guru Premanande. Hari Hari Bol.